Thank you for downloading from the BBC. For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
Well, the theme for the international documentary series Global Perspective this year is At the Edge. In the UK, no one is more marginalised than asylum seekers, whose claims can take many years to be accepted or refused. Almost weekly, there are stories in the British press about the huge backlogs in the asylum system and the pressures put on asylum seekers by those years of living in limbo. For the BBC World Service, Jenny Cuff investigates.
There's a time when your mind comes to say, I cannot do anything. I'm now desperate. I cannot say anything. In fact, nobody is going to believe me.
7 years is a long time, very long time of my life. Living in a hope and in limbo.
Colin from Zimbabwe and Thomas from Eritrea believe their lives will be in danger if they return home. For the BBC World Service, I've visited the subject of migration and asylum in the past, but never on my own doorstep in the UK. Asylum seekers are dispersed around the country, mostly to large cities where there's cheaper accommodation, but 200 are sent to the south coast city of Southampton, near where I live.
This is Shelley. Yes, quite a good place to live. I came here in Southampton in 2008 in January. And when I came here, I was given a house.
From the government?
That's from the government, yes. So now they've they've taken their house back and I don't have a house to live in now. It's only a friend's house, which I'm going to.
Colin, a tall, dignified man in his early 50s, is one of 60% of asylum seekers whose application to remain in the UK has been rejected. In other words, he's a failed asylum seeker, a person with no rights, no accommodation or benefits, who survives on handouts from organisations and people who take pity on him.
I was talking with my friend here. She said, oh, no, I'm living alone. If she wanted to come to my house, and I could see that she was talking with all her heart. So I said, anyway, let me try to live with her. Of course, at any time, she has the right to say, no, I had enough with you. You can go wherever you want with this type of a weather.
It's been hard finding people who will talk to the BBC for this programme.
Only the Home Office, what they say is go back to your country, volunteer to go. How can I volunteer to go and I know that there's danger there?
An elderly lady called Johanna has saved him from homelessness.
Hello.
Hello.
We are here, Johanna.
Okay, do sit down.
Colin and Johanna have got to know each other through voluntary work at the local hospital. She's from Holland, but she came to Britain after the Second World War and married a Pole, so she understands what it's like to be a stranger in a foreign land. We sit at a table in her cluttered front room while Colin fetches his official documents from the Home Office. So when did you meet Colin?
In hospital, when we were selling papers and chocolate and drinks to the patients. And it happened that he was, well, to put together with me, because he was on his own. And
did you know he was an asylum seeker?
Well, not the first days, no. But, yeah, gradually I learned more about it, yes. I was actually quite shocked.
Why were you shocked?
That they're not allowed to work and not allowed to earn some money. And I think it's terrible. Because they want to work, he wants to work.
I suppose the government think that if they work, then it will be harder to send them back home if it's comes to that.
Probably as well, but he is rather scared, I think, to go back home because of that he did not support President Mugabe.
So what made you offer a place to Colin?
Well, I did like him and we got on very well with our job in the hospital, and I sort of got a spare room upstairs anyway, I can sleep there.
And when you tell your friends that he is staying or they ask about him, what kind of attitude do they have?
Well, actually, most of my friends didn't take that much notice. Only my daughter-in-law, she said, I don't believe it. What he tells, he's just telling you stories and you believe everything, she said. And she was also annoyed about the fact that they should not be allowed to work, she said, because the job should all work for the British people and not for foreigners. That's another thing she said.
What do you say to your daughter-in-law?
I said, I'm convinced every word he said is absolutely true.
Sometimes I don't like to see these papers.
What was the latest? What is the latest that you've had? In Zimbabwe, Colin worked with the Air Force as a dog handler. When he first joined, it was still the Rhodesian Air Force, and he was fighting against his fellow countrymen, men like Robert Mugabe, who were battling for independence. That's why he's frightened by the president's anti-British, anti-colonial rhetoric. He came to England as a visitor in 2006 and decided to stay when he heard from his wife that ZANU-PF supporters were looking for him.
When I claimed asylum, the life is horrible, to tell the truth. A horrible life. Nobody would like to live a life like this. Let me give an example. If I used to watch boxing some time ago, you could see two men fighting. And you could say this one is winning, this one is losing. You could see these people are fighting. But somebody will just use a technical way to fight somebody. You see, in this country, to tell the truth, there is a technical way of torturing somebody without beating you, without doing you anything. But that is a torture. Imagine there are some people, of course, who claim asylum here. They are young, they are not allowed to go to work. Maybe those young people, they want to go to school, they cannot go to school. Imagine. So it's a technical torture. At the same time, you are just waiting. You don't know what is going to happen to you.
Over the last 3 years, Colin has put in two claims for asylum. The first was rejected, and so was a subsequent appeal. Then he managed to get further evidence for his case and put in a fresh claim. But again, this was rejected in September last year.
When my fresh claim was refused, it wasn't a good day at all. It wasn't a good day. I can see myself, I'm just a useless person.
He's been advised to put in another application. But in the meantime, he feels his dignity has been stripped away. The immigration authorities say his story lacks credibility.
As for now, I'm very, very confused now. I don't know what to say now. If you tell somebody that I've seen a stone, and somebody is going to say, no, I did not see a stone, you have seen water, and you really telling him the truth that I've seen stone, and he say, no, you've seen water. You know, you get confused. It's about my case, what I'm talking about this. Because what I'm telling them, it is the truth, but they are not even believe me at all. So I'm very, very confused.
Colin isn't the only one to be confused by the asylum process in the UK, which is constantly changing. To help me understand it, I've come to see Neil Amas, who runs the Information Centre about Asylum and Refugees, an independent research organisation at City University in London. Why do some of these cases take so long?
Some may be purely because of the complexity of the case, but generally speaking, it's administrative delays on the account of the Home Office, and that is the very, very much the main reason people are here for a long, long time and their cases just have not been resolved. And there are others who are refused asylum, but the government decrees they are not able to go back because their country is not safe. Those people are usually offered Section 4 support, which is a subsistence and accommodation allowance for people who have been refused asylum, but their countries are not safe to return to, for example, Zimbabwe. The unfortunate thing for those people is they can't really get on with their lives here because they know they're not allowed to stay here in the long term, but they also can't go back, so they're caught in that situation.
Although he's from Zimbabwe, Colin hasn't received the accommodation and subsistence allowance because it would mean signing a document agreeing to return home when the government deems it safe, and he's reluctant to do that. The library's popular with asylum seekers because they can use the internet, and this is where I meet a slim 23-year-old from Eritrea. He doesn't want to use his real name when speaking to the BBC, so I'll call him Thomas. He arrived in the UK on the eve of his 16th birthday after travelling by plane from Kenya with an agent or trafficker. At first, he's a bit reluctant to talk to me, but gradually opens up.
The good thing about it is you're safe, and the bad thing is you just don't have anything to do. You're not a complete man. You see people go to work, go to school, but you can't do that, and that's a bad thing.
Thomas is of mixed parentage, his father an Eritrean, his mother from Ethiopia. When his father died, the family moved to Ethiopia. But when war broke out between the two countries, he was seen as one of the enemies, so they found the money to send him away to safety. On arriving at Heathrow Airport, he applied for asylum. That was 7 years ago. And you came as a child,
yeah.
And now you're a man and a father.
Yes, I'm a man and father now. I'm not a boy anymore.
So in a sense, you've grown up in England, haven't
yes,
you?
Yes, I did. I did grow up. I acclimatised myself with this society, so I know more about this society than my own society now. Yeah.
Do you have any contact with Eritrea? Do you have any family members that you're in touch with?
No, I don't have any contact with anyone, and that's bad as well.
Some people would say it would be better to be back in your own country, however dangerous, rather than living this kind of life that you all seem to be leading here as failed asylum seekers or asylum seekers in limbo, in waiting.
I don't know about that. It's good to live rather than to die, and things might pass, things might change. If the president is not anymore president, then things might improve. If there is a good relationship with the rest of the world, then we will have a good chance of returning back. It's good to live in your own country. To be honest, I don't hate my country. I love my country. Whether you are poor or rich, it's good to be in your own country.
Especially at a time of recession, it's understandable that the public should be worried about the pressure of incomers on overstretched public services. But looking at some of the tabloid newspapers, you'd be hard put to find a more marginalised and reviled group than asylum seekers.
I prefer not to explain about myself to anybody. If they can figure it out, they figure it out. I don't mind, but I wouldn't say, hey, my name is Thomas and I'm an asylum seeker. I wouldn't say that. She don't like any sport, which I like every sport. And I'm the remote holder.
And you've got the controller.
I've got the control, so...
Now that Thomas has got to know me a bit better, he's invited me to his bedsit close to Southampton Docks in a house he shares with 10 others. And for the first time, I meet Zoe, his 10-month-old baby daughter, dressed in a frilly skirt and woolly white tights. Hey, that's a nice toy.
We're happy that we have her. Yeah, we're happy. I wouldn't change her for anything.
There must be hundreds of families sitting at home like this on a Saturday afternoon, but it's not something Thomas and his partner Elsa can take for granted. Elsa, who's also Eritrean, has a separate asylum claim, and the Home Office has housed her and Zoe in Portsmouth, 20 miles away. So she and Thomas only see each other at weekends when they've saved enough money for the bus fare. Elsa, what's your situation here in this country?
Still waiting. So there is no decide yet. So hopefully I'm waiting.
And how long have you been here?
6 years.
6 years and still waiting?
Yeah, still waiting.
And have you... Have you applied and been failed and then applied and failed again?
No, still waiting.
It's your original case is still being heard?
Yeah.
Do you know why it's taking so long?
No, not yet.
So what can you do when you're together? I mean, now this weekend, for instance, what are you going to do together?
I'm trying to give her a hand if she wants to go and relax herself. I'll babysit Zoe and she goes. Just to relax, to free her mind and do the baby thing here.
Right, so you'll stay behind with
Zoe. I'll stay behind in charge and she'll be fine with me.
When you're here and Thomas can look after Zoe, is that a good feeling that you can actually walk out and be free just for a short time?
Yes, it's very good.
It's good, I bet.
Yeah.
And do you have friends here you can go and see?
Yeah, because I used to live in Southampton before.
So why did you have to move to Portsmouth?
Because the Home Office, they moved me there.
Right.
They say they don't have accommodation in Southampton, that's why.
So, what's your hope for the future?
Hoping everything is going to be sorted out and we to live together.
To live as a family?
Yes.
Just live in hope, I suppose.
Yes, live in hope,
Living in a hope and in limbo.
Here we are.
Well, sometimes.
Good morning, legal friends. Selling newspapers, magazines, drinks, sun.
Ex-Air Force man Colin wards off despair by throwing himself into voluntary work. Tuesday is his day to help the League of Friends at Southampton General Hospital. The tall Zimbabwean wheels a trolley of papers and snacks round the busy surgical wards.
Mostly in this one now, they are elder people. Yes. So I need to be very slow, patient, and sure. I'll say that. Because I need them to have papers. You know, once they have papers, some of them they do enjoy very much. Mm. Yes. Good morning, illegal friends. We're selling newspapers, magazines.
Express.
Johanna?
Yes.
He disarms his customers with his warm smile and his old-style courtesy.
Magazines, anyone like to buy? Thank you.
For these few hours, Colin forgets he's got no legal right to be in this country and becomes a person with value to society.
It's only if somebody knows you that you are an asylum seeker. He takes you as a very, very poor person, a person who doesn't even think at all, you know. That is what he takes you like that. But when you are here doing voluntary, they don't know me. They don't know my life. You know, once those people, they say I smile. You know, it's those people who makes me smiling, because if they look at you, they've got a smile of saying, oh, somebody have brought us something. So by the way that person smiles, I smile too. You know, he makes me cheerful, and he's a person who is not going to ask you what do you earn for a living. He's just a person going to ask me, do you have such type of a chocolate? Do you have a daily echo? Things like that. So we start chatting. So it helps me a lot when I'm here, because mostly I forgot all those things which are worrying me, you see.
The asylum system appears harsh to those who experience it, but the British government says the majority of claims are groundless. 7 years ago, the number of asylum seekers in the UK reached record levels at around 80,000. It's now down to around 25,000. And Neil Amos at City University says that may partly be due to the many recent policy changes.
I would describe it as, in terms of the asylum process, an ongoing attempt to streamline the system, to make it more efficient, to get people through the system more quickly so that they can either be granted status or removed from the country as soon as possible.
And is there any sign that it's being successful in its aims?
In terms of making the system more efficient and quicker, certainly there are signs that people are being processed more quickly now than they were, say, 5 years ago. so asylum claims are being dealt with more quickly. There is still a large backlog of people who haven't been seen, who have been here for 5, 10 years, who are really in limbo. That is being cleared, but it's still a long way to go. I think a lot of people would argue that it hasn't been a very easy time for asylum seekers themselves over the last 5 to 10 years.
On Fridays, the United Reform Church on the main avenue leading to Southampton is transformed into a multicultural centre. And today there's a special lunch for asylum seekers.
What are you cooking here, Mina?
Rice,
curry chicken,
and two different rice.
And you're cooking for how many people?
For 150.
I've noticed a curious contradiction in the UK's attitude to asylum seekers. In the public imagination, they're fraudsters and spongers. Yet the people putting on this lunch for them are part of a vast network of volunteers who sympathise with their plight and try to help. Both Colin and Thomas are here, tucking into a fantastic meal.
Chicken and a sort of samosa and the rice, which is mixed up from carrots, peas. It's quite nice.
Mm. Is it unusual to get such a good meal?
Yes, it is.
You couldn't afford this if you had to pay for it?
I cannot afford this myself, no. Unless, if I was a person who is working, of course, I can afford this. Because I like eating. Sometimes I don't like to chat with people or to sit with people because sometimes I'll be very stressed, you know. So, like today, I didn't want to come, but tell the truth.
So you just weren't feeling in a good mood this morning?
Yeah, no, not at all. Because, you know, eating like this, sitting with other people just like this, I'm not in this type of a life. It's only for this hour here. Soon I'll be away on my own life, which is horrible life, you know.
Hope is very good. You have to have hope to live. Otherwise, if you haven't got hope, it's not good. You damage yourself. But I still have hope, yeah. I still have hope. I'll probably have some good news in the future. I still have hope.
Living in Limbo was presented by Jenny Cuff and produced by Kate Howells for the BBC World Service. It was part of the international documentary series Global Perspective. Next week, a soprano in Canada loses her voice as she charts her first year of becoming a man.
There are dozens of different podcasts now available from the BBC, including news, documentaries, science, business, arts and sport. For details of them all, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.